Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, May 11th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Precious Metals Market Report. Oh boy, I couldn't wait for this one. The correction that Franklin and I have been talking about in our last reports is upon us, but it happened with a bang and not with a whimper, so we've got an awful lot to talk about. We're going to talk about not just what happened, but what's next. We'll also cover the next dates in our series, Precious Metals, the top 10 dates in American history. We've updated that transcript with the last one, and it's up at both your cart and the Precious Metals Library. If you haven't, if you're a new subscriber and you haven't used the Precious Metals Market Library, you can find the link to it in one of the beginning entries at your cart, and it's a wonderful compendium where you can access all the precious metals Solari reports and things that we post related to precious metals. Our theme tonight, not surprisingly, is precious metals rock and roll. You know, there's an old saying we used to use on Wall Street, first they rock you, then they roll you, and it certainly felt that way in the precious metals market. But first, money and markets. I wanted to comment on last week's interview, which I found to be enormously useful. It was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff and now a professor at William & Mary and sometimes teaches at George Washington. It was a very rich conversation if you haven't heard it. And it brought out a lot of the things I wanted to bring out, and it was pretty wonderful kind of to get somebody who's still in some sense a Washington insider talking about pipeline politics of the Middle East, the role of contractors, the risks endured by public officials, some of the difficulties of trying to extract the military from the Middle East, a lot of very good stuff. What was funny was he felt very adamant and obligated to push the official story on a couple of issues, one of which was 9/11. And I got some feedback from subscribers wanting to know why I gave him such a pass on that one, and that was, you know, that wasn't a topic I wanted to get into, and it's one of those topics that you could just go down the rabbit hole. But I did think it was interesting that the official story which Wilkerson promoted is the idea that not only did Osama bin Laden do 9/11, for which there's, to my knowledge, there's no evidence to suggest that that's really the case, but that he did it on a budget of $500,000. And it's funny because, you know, I almost said to Wilkerson, you know, I couldn't run Hamilton Securities for 3 weeks on $500,000. So maybe we need to get bin Laden back to, you know, run America, because he could certainly run the federal government for $100 million a year if he could do that 9/11 for $500,000. But I've been scratching my head all week trying to figure out why it's so important to the establishment to use a lie that is that completely outrageous. It's almost like a fraternity pledge. If you'll stand up and say something like that, you know, you get to be in the fraternity. But there's a logic to it, but I haven't figured it out. I've been, because of what has been going on in and around the claim that Osama bin Laden's been killed, I've gotten a lot of requests on 9/11 issues, including the different scientists and issues on the nature of the weaponry. And I continue to study and look at that material. And I've arranged for some of the scientists I trust to talk to them about it. But again, until I get somebody who can vet it for me, I'm hesitant to get into it. There are a lot of radio shows that I do, including Coast to Coast, who have a lot of that material on. And there's a wide variety of programming that they use, and they have a lot more hours to fill up. Here, the Solari Report is for something that's much more carefully vetted, because we're really interested in helping people with their personal finance and health. So a lot more time goes into vetting things, and I hope you appreciate that that's the case. Money and markets. Rolling Stone has outdone themselves up on the block. Their new story called People versus Goldman Sachs, which is really an aggregation and compendium of all their links documenting Goldman Sachs, is outrageous, particularly in the mortgage market and coming into the bust of the housing bubble. This time they're calling for an indictment. And interestingly enough, now that Buffett has gotten his money out of Goldman, and we just saw the Galleon hedge fund conviction occur, believe it or not, this is a much greater possibility. Now, the thing that's triggered their story, the sort of inspiration for it, is that Carl Levin's Senate Subcommittee on Investigations has just released a 650-page report called Wall Street and the Financial Crisis, Anatomy of a Financial Collapse. I haven't begun to digest the whole thing, but our wonderful Darlene Heckman dug it out and got the PDF up on the blog with the Rolling Stone article. So if you want to dive in, Levin and his team have a real history of diving in and getting the goods on people and then dishing it up in a way that the Department of Justice can much more easily do something about it. So it'll be very interesting. One of the things they promote is one of the tales of Goldman Sachs burning Morgan Stanley in the mortgage market. Morgan Stanley, if you go market by market, is one of the firms that could probably benefit the most from a Goldman indictment. And if the time has come that serious competitors of Goldman have reached a point where they feel the world is better off with a Goldman Sachs indictment, I think it is possible. Who knows what the odds are yet? So let's see what happens. One other point to remember is Obama's coming into a presidential campaign. The Democrats are coming into a presidential campaign. Believe it or not, the bankers, you know, as I said before, no president has made as much money off of Goldman Sachs as no president has made as much money from the no president has delivered as much money to the bankers as Obama has. So Obama really has engineered more money into the bankers' pockets. They have a reason to want to see him as president winning in 2012. But he's got a couple of image problems, to say the least. One is, he needed to get rid of Larry Summers. But he also needs a serious criminal indictment because no one has been arrested or really indicted and convicted. We now have this Galleon conviction. And so it's going to be really interesting to see if a Goldman Sachs indictment, which would clearly do it, it would clearly give him a clean bill of health. On the Middle East front, we see the Iranians moving to get their nuclear facility operational. The Russians are now offering some very important help, and that's a story to keep watching. Treasury struggling on the financing the deficit, managing the dollar. They've been trying to engineer several stock sales of their GM stock and AIG, both stocks taking a beating, and they're backing off. They're also managing the debt limit. The current deadline is August 2nd, that could be tricky. I just want to do a sound check. Anais, can you hear me?
Yes, you're loud and
okay.
Clear.
Okay, we've been having phone trouble, so I'm just going to do a sound check occasionally. Okay, so August 2nd is the debt limit. We've been seeing a lot of different squabbles about it. Essentially, the debt limit in many senses is an unimportant issue, but it is an issue where Congress can, a congressional fight can blackmail, it can hold up a toll booth and it can create a blackmail situation. And so if the Republicans decide to strong arm, you see all sorts of political games go on, including games that could hurt the value in the trading of the dollar. So it's important to watch as a political consideration. It's not an important financial consideration. So it's both unimportant and important, but there are a lot of games brewing up around it. And if we have till August 2nd, a lot can go on. But it's one of the reasons you see, I think, Treasury struggling to do some of the stock sales. I wanted to mention my hero today, interestingly enough, relates to a story about what's happening in the South down on the Mississippi. James Quaid is really the first Solari Report subscriber from Arizona. He's the one who in 2000 came to me and said, you've got to do a report by email. It was then called the Solari Action Network, but he was the one who got me to do it. And Jim is a very nuts and bolts guy. He's got a lot of experience in the military and enforcement. He's a natural-born engineer and inventor, and he's one of my go-to guys on two subjects. One is alternative energy, and interestingly enough, he's from New Orleans and has an incredible knowledge of New Orleans and the Mississippi Delta. And all through Katrina, he was sending me all sorts of amazing information. He's one of very perceptive guy, looks into the anomalies. I've always believed that if you really wanted to fix America and rebuild our economy, all you had to do was unleash the engineers inventors like Jim Quaid, because there are hundreds of them just, you know, who literally have had their hands and legs tied. And it's quite amazing what they could do. But one of the things he did about 2 weeks ago, he started sending me these emails saying, heads up on what's going on in the Mississippi. And here's what's going on. We see the Mississippi River flooding. And a big question right now is, will the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers open up what's called the Morganza Spillway, which will prevent the flooding of New Orleans? New Orleans has unbelievably important refinery and oil operations. If we get a flooding of New Orleans, it's going to be an interesting situation for the oil card. In theory, could help really promote up the oil price. If the Corps of Engineers open up the spillway, you could see literally a permanent change in the flow of the Mississippi River around New Orleans. And you're looking at what could be for the transportation and energy infrastructure of America, a pretty big change. And we'll know the rise of the water in Mississippi is in Memphis is supposed to reach, I think, its height tonight, and going into Mississippi and Louisiana. So this is a pretty immediate story, but it's going to be very interesting because literally the export in America that is growing more and more important is agriculture, and New Orleans is our biggest port and is literally the door to the Midwest and the agricultural market. So keep an eye on New Orleans and what happens in Mississippi. It's important. We have a couple questions that I thought I would handle before we do the precious metals market report. And so let me just go through them and ask Catherine. I was asked a source of retirement planning. My favorite source of retirement planning information and books is the American Institute for Economic Research. We had their president on late last year to do if something should happen. It was either in December, could have been the beginning of this year. If Something Should Happen is one of my favorite sort of workbooks for planning for your retirement or just planning for the worst case. They have lots of other good information. I like them very much for retirement planning, not for investment strategy. And for, oddly enough, for investment strategy, the things I like the best are our own audio seminars. And another source I depend a lot on, interestingly enough, is Franklin Sanders, The Money Changer. So I would really use the Salieri Report archives and the audio seminars and then Franklin's body of work to help you on investment strategy. So if you combine the retirement planning at AIER.org is their website and our investment strategy, I think it will really put you in good condition. An update on the Zurich Canton Bank. We're still working on the research, so stay tuned for that response. My expectation is we're probably going to write a special report on it as well as cover it in the Salieri Report. Someone asked, I was looking through the archives but did not find what I was looking for on your list of the top 10 books. I haven't yet put together the list, but I have been covering the books in the Salieri Report. So if you go back and look at the books we've been covering, they're generally all ones that are going to be on that list, but I do intend to finalize that list. It'll probably be 20. A great question on Gary Shilling and inflation versus deflation and whether or not hyperinflation can be offset by deflation of, I'll use words different than the person who asked the question, deflation by deflating labor and reducing population. And the answer is yes. There are many things we can do, including new technology, to significantly offset with other kinds of deflation the inflationary effects of monetary policy, and that's one reason why I'm a believer in the slow burn scenario and find myself sort of in a different camp than many of the people who are interested in promote gold. Promise Software. Could you do a show on Promise Software? I just finished reading Sherry Seymour's The Last Circle, and I know you were interested in the Promise investigation. That's a great suggestion. One of the things I always say to people, if you're interested in learning about Promise Software, Bill Hamilton, the developer of Promise Software, whose company Inslaw had it stolen from them by the government, I once called Bill and he said, have you read Michael Thomas's book, Black Money? And I said, no. He said, read it and call me back. And the reason he did that is that he didn't want to sit on the phone and explain Promise Software to me. And I find Thomas's book, Black Money, which is just a sort of a pulp fiction beach reading, to be a great introduction to the software and understanding the power of those kinds of software tools. But we will definitely, that's a great suggestion, and it's on the list. A question about Dr. Stevens Jones's video on engineered earthquakes. I went ahead and put that up on the blog. It, you know, he's going at the same question I'm very interested in, which is, what is the invisible weaponry that's really driving economic warfare, and how does it work, and what are we dealing with? Of course, again, a very squiggly area. Somebody asked, what portion of assets do you recommend be put into precious metal stocks, housing, cash, and other? You know, my other day job is I'm an investment advisor, and what I find is there's tremendous latitude in what is optimal for a person given all sorts of unique circumstances, not only how much money they have, but what their goals are, what their tolerance for different kinds of issues are. And so I find it impossible to give formulas on these things without looking at, you know, breaking it down into lots of different fact patterns. And I kind of get violent on this issue now because so often people come to me for consultations and I find that they've done, you know, just they've really done the wrong thing, and it's because they listen to some very persuasive person pushing a formula, and it really drives me crazy because many times, for example, in the gold world, you'll see everybody saying buy or sell, and that makes sense for, you know, say 80% of the cases, but it doesn't make sense for all. So, you know, the philosophy that each person is unique is a good one. A question about the Chinese bubble and a request that we do more to cover the Chinese bubble. I think that's a very good idea, and it's interesting. I've been looking for weeks and approaching people about doing one on the China bubble, and I will continue to do that. But if you have recommendations for someone you'd like to hear on the China bubble, please, I encourage you to send it to me. Okay, well, needless to say, I'm in California, and I'm homesick for Tennessee, but I'm really homesick for being around Franklin Sanders. as silver was, you know, taking its nosedive, you know, it looked like an air show. I could, you know, I wanted to call you, Franklin, every 5 minutes. What's happening now? What's going on? And so, you know, I said to my team earlier today, I said, I cannot wait to do this precious metals report because I get to talk to Franklin for almost an hour. Anyway, Franklin, so how are you?
I'm fine, but you know, you left out the big story.
What's the big story?
Well, you talked about Osama bin Laden being killed, but you didn't say anything about Bigfoot being killed in Japan. And that raises all kinds of issues because they're our ally.
Oh, Lord.
Well, I'm just watching, that's all. Silver and gold clearly made a peak, and it's a little odd because there are really two lows in the ratio, one on the 25th of April and one on the 29th, and then on the 2nd of May, gold by 70 cents made its final high, and then you got a tremendous drop from there, and that, of course, set all of the heads to talking about how that proved that silver and gold were in a bubble and so forth, and so I went and dug out all my statistics so I could compare what happened in 1980 to what happened in the last few days. I went back 265 days in 1980, which is to take in all, you know, two-thirds of the last year before the very peak. And I did the same in 2011. And what shows up is that in 1980, silver rose 6.18 times in 265 days. That means it climbed from $8.15 on the 1st of May of 79 to $50.35 on the 21st of January of 1980. Now, if you look at what happened in 2011, the peak is 2.64 times. So that's less than half as much. And you have to put that 2.64 times in comparison against the previous peaks that we've seen in this bull market. In 2004, it was 171%. In 2006, 212%. And in 2008, 158%. So 2.64 times is high, but it's not that much higher than 2006, really. So
well, and there's something else. $50 in 1980 is worth how much today?
Oh, goodness.
If you, yeah.
Well,
yeah, so we're talking about a much higher price.
Right, exactly. And so it just looks different. The shape of the curve is not the same. It's not nearly as parabolic. And remember, we didn't go from $8 to $50. We went from $18.23 to $48.58. It's just not the same thing. As far as gold is concerned, in 1980, gold rose 3.47 times in 265 days. It went from $247 to $861. In 2011, it rose 1.3 times, from $1,200 to $1,556. So those rises really aren't comparable. I mean, they could possibly be a blow-off, but considering the short amount of time that's elapsed since this bull market began in 2001, and considering how much shorter the price increase is in this bull market so far, it's just unlikely that that was a bubble blowing off. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's terribly unlikely. So,
well, the thing that made me the most uncomfortable, as you know, was, I just thought it was an interim. What I call them interim pumps and dumps, but what was making me uncomfortable was, we'd gotten such big gains in last year, but then when Fukushima happened, I got really nervous and said, gold is going to be it's the best place to be if event risk gets out of hand. But the other thing was, and I've got a bug under my what about this, if you look at the gold bugs who were promoting the price up, they were getting as ridiculous and untrustworthy as the guys who were pushing it down.
Right.
And so you had an ugliness about the whole thing that was lacking in being grounded. So
right.
Clearly, so now I just think it's an interim pump and dump in a long-term bull market, but it certainly was unattractive.
Well, and it points out that, Bunker Hunt's father, H.L. Hunt, great fellow, literally got incredibly rich in the oil business, but was a very serious fellow, and he used to say, never get too elated in victory or never get too down in defeat. And if you're going to adopt a strategy of following the primary trend, that is that you buy and hold, you're not trying to buy price point to price point, you're trying to buy a long piece out of a very long move, then you have to avoid getting dragged into all that crazy enthusiasm, and you have to sort of stay calm. But you do want to look for the ultimate peak. One of the mistakes that most investors make is they don't sell. They fall in love with an investment, and then it comes time to sell. Like early 2000 was the time to sell stocks, and they've made so much money, they can't turn loose of them.
Right.
They fall in love with them, and so I think one of the things that I always try to impress on people is, there'll be a time to get out, but we've got an indicator that tells us when that time will be, and it's not the percentage rise of silver, it's not a price target in the sense of a dollar price target. Gold could go to $6,000, gold could go to $2,000, $3,000, it could go to $15,000. I don't know where it's going to go, but there's one point I know when I will be getting out of the gold and silver market, or I will be making adjustments. And that is whenever I see the ratio of silver to gold, whenever I see that 1 ounce of gold costs 16 ounces of silver or less, that's time to get out. At the same time, I also want to see that the whole Dow costs 2 ounces of gold or less. Probably it'll be one. But those two things are relative value markers that will get us out at the right time, I think.
Right. Well, what Turk has always said is, if you go back and you look at the relationship between paper and real and tangibles, you know, that the tangible bull market has peaked when an ounce of gold buys the Dow.
Right.
And, you know, you go back and you see these long fluctuations between paper and tangibles. And I think, you know, it's so important to just sit back and look at this whole thing, because it's the same debate is happening not just in precious metals, but if you go throughout the commodities markets and you look at portfolios of, you know, are you going to be in real things or are you going to be in paper? And the volatility keeps scaring investors back into paper. But if you look at the long-term trends, that's just about the worst place they could be.
You know, they have a mathematical problem. They're mathematically challenged. And their mathematical challenge is that they've got the wrong denominator. When people tell me there's too much volatility, it tells me they don't know the right denominator. It means that their denominator is a paper dollar. And they think that it never changes. Well, goodness gracious, if you look at the chart of the dollar index, you can see that it's gone from 120 in 2001 down to 70 in, 2006 or 2008. So that's what's volatile, the silver and gold.
You know, I remember you told me in, I think it was 2003 or 2004, that I had to stop thinking in the dollar. And I said, you know, he's right. And I tried to do it. And it took me a couple years. It was a difficult switch. And part of it was I needed to price everything in gallons of gasoline. So I'll give you an example. I was on Coast to Coast early this week, and they just wanted me to do a new segment on housing. So I sat down and I did the calculation. The housing market peaked in June 2006. And if you look at the drop in the housing market since June 2006, the median home has dropped 30% in dollars, 50% in gallons of gasoline, and 72% in ounces of gold.
Right.
Pretty
See
amazing.
See how much difference it makes?
It's huge, because somebody, if you say to me, if I need $5 million by the time I retire, can I earn that? And I say, well, how fast is the dollar going to drop? Because if it drops really fast, you can have it by next year.
Well, let me give you another example. The stock market today at about 12,675 is actually higher than it was in January, at the peak in January of 2000, when it was 11,722. So if you look at that and you think in dollars, you say, oh, well, look, I mean, it hadn't gone very far, but at least I'm even. No, you're not even. If you measure it in silver or gold, you're down almost 90%.
Right.
So that doesn't, you know, you have to learn to think in terms of value, not in terms of paper dollars. But let me go back to something you said about gold and silver. Silver dropped 27.5% the first week that it broke. And I think there are two things that are going on here, two increases in volatility. Number one is you've got a slightly different information transfer today than you had 30 years ago. And with the internet speeds up and computers speed up the propagation of things. I think you're also seeing an increase in people who want in hot money, people who are looking for something to invest in, and that includes hedge funds and everybody. But you're also seeing an increase because silver and gold have gotten through the first rise of a bull market, and now they've entered the second rise. And that first rise is pretty slow. You know, it's rising at about a 15 or 20% angle. Then suddenly you get into the second rise, and it starts going up at, you know, 30, 40%, 45% angle. So there's going to be more volatility in connection with that. I'm wondering if if the Galleon conviction is going to affect that volatility or not. It's certainly going to make everybody a lot more scared, everybody who manages money a lot more scared. But I'm not sure that I agree that the fellow that they convicted was that important. I mean, he was not, after all, working for Goldman Sachs or one of the other big names. And it's typical of the government that they choose a scapegoat who, in the end, can't protect himself. He doesn't have any sponsorship, so to speak. So,
right. Now, that's one of the reasons I find this report from the Senate so interesting, because I would think if you're the Obama candidate, you know, if you're Obama's backers, he needs a good indictment and conviction. He really, politically, needs it. Now,
Catherine, you're not saying that they engage in prosecutions on a political basis.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, look how much money the bankers have made from Obama. You know,
sure.
They've got a big investment here, so I can't imagine. You know, I think that's why they got rid of Summers. It just got too embarrassing to have him around. And the question has been continuously asked: why has no one been convicted? And clearly, the Galleon conviction is not enough. But I do think it will make. You know, the prosecutors are generally scared, but I do think it will embolden them a little bit. And the question is, you know, would they be willing to take on somebody as powerful as Goldman Sachs? Now, normally I would say no, but Buffett is getting his money out makes a big change, and a Senate report that's done a lot of work for him makes a big change too.
Right.
So, you know, who knows? But
you know, the thing to remember about that is that when their support collapses, the rats will all leave the boat at the same time.
Right.
When they go down, they'll go down really, really fast. Because
right. Well,
everybody with their finger to the wind will see what's coming and they'll run.
Right. Well, here's the thing. With the new legislation, proprietary profits are harder to get. And that means, you know, a big guy going down is a pickup in market share for a lot of the competitors. So, particularly with the financial reform legislation, there's and of course, you've had... Normally, to indict, let alone convict somebody like Goldman Sachs, you need the intelligence agencies, in a variety, and Department of Justice to go along with it. And normally, I would say that could never happen. But if you look at how many people Goldman has angered, particularly in the AIG situation, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's possible. I think we'll just have to wait and see. But needless to say, the politics, you know, the it's what I call the Midianite thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's more reason for the Midianites to fight, and there gets to be more each week. This every sign I've gotten from things I know in my, you know, that where I connect back to the tape room in my life, every message, Franklin, is that the system is feeling incredibly fragile, just incredibly fragile. So, and that means these swings of fear and greed that we're seeing, including in the precious metals market, can be so dramatic, because that sense or that insecurity in the leadership makes for these kinds of situations.
Well, there's been building for a number of years, 10 years at least, this feeling of malaise, this feeling that things were not reliable, just a general and often undefined feeling of malaise, and that's the reason why. That you have to watch out for fear and greed, and you have to try to exclude fear and greed from your calculations and your plans, because you know, once you get into the middle of a run up like that, the recent silver spike, the only thing you hear is enthusiasm. So your
right.
greed is being reinforced on every side, and your fear that you're going to miss out on it, and. You know, this is the reason why we've been recommending for years get into gold and silver before the real rises start, because it's only going to get worse from here. But the thing that folks who already own gold and silver need to understand is you can't get sucked up by that fear and greed. You have to start with a strategy that aligns you with the primary trend, and then you've got to hang on to it.
Well, I would also say it this way. I think it's very important. We've seen all sorts of gold bugs who were promoting a rising price during the rise.
Yeah.
And it's very, very, what I've learned is it's very, very important for someone who's not a professional trader to understand that they're promoting their book. In other words, they have a point of view and they're promoting their book. So we have Eric Sprott, he's promoting his book and he gets out at the high. What they're not doing is they're not offering investment advice designed to help you. They're promoting their book. And so there's a difference, you know, just because they're for a rising price does not mean they're on your side. So it's very important to understand that they're, you know, yes, they're for gold, they're for silver, but they're speculators and they're promoting their book. And that's different than somebody who's trying to give you investment advice that's in your best interest.
It's like a farmer who raises pigs. He's always going to encourage you to have a ham sandwich.
Right.
I mean, that's what you have to realize is going on with these
right.
people. And the fact that they handled millions of dollars, billions of dollars, doesn't change that a bit. They're trying to sell you a ham sandwich, so you'll buy some of their product.
Right, exactly.
Well, back to the silver and gold. I think you haven't seen the end of it yet. These corrections rarely end in less than 35 days or so, and generally they'll go on 65 or even longer, out to 90 days, before they hit a bottom. So you've got a time window for a bottom that really begins about 34 days and stretches out to 90. Usually by 90, the bottom has been made. I say usually because there are exceptions to that. And we're going into this season of the year when silver and gold normally don't do well. That is, they take a rest usually in June and July, and it's considerably unusual to get, it's almost never heard of to get a high in June or July. It's common to get lows, especially in the end of June, beginning of July time. So in addition to this correction that's just begun, you're coming into a seasonal low period. So I think we'll get a really good buying opportunity here shortly. That would be probably silver will go back to its 200-day moving average. That's a typical target for corrections in silver's bull market. Remember, silver is much more volatile than gold, and it could even go to the 300-day moving average. The 200-day moving average right now is about 28.50, roughly, working its way towards $30. So somewhere between now and then, we might see that happen. The volatility has been excruciating. Silver today traded from low to high in a 10.2% range. That's just, it's just unheard of.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Let me go back and mention something that I wanted to talk about, and that was the margin hikes. They hiked the margins beginning, I think, in November. They began hiking the margins on silver, that is the futures exchange. Now, a lot of people see a conspiracy in that. But it's the same conspiracy that's always been going on since futures exchanges have been there, because they don't run the futures exchanges for the public. They run them for the benefit of the members of the exchange. And so whenever their position is threatened, as it was in 1980, they're going to change the rule. They're going to raise margins first. And if that doesn't kill the move, then they will change the rules altogether. They did that in silver. They raised margin levels in silver over and over in 1979 and 80. And finally, they changed the rules altogether and lowered position limits to ridiculous levels. And then on the 21st of January of 1980, they said you couldn't initiate any new positions. You could only liquidate long positions. So they, in effect, closed out trading from the short side. So that was bound to break the market. But if it had been potatoes, if it had been eggs, if it had been bananas, it would have been the same thing. They're going to break the market. They're going to try to break the market if they feel like it's hurting them. So is that a conspiracy or not? Well, maybe, but it's the eternal conspiracy. So, you know, the market
right, there's no reason to be surprised. This was in fact, I thought they were slow to, you know, they were slow to slow it down.
Right. And you have to anybody has to understand that when a market is going straight up, when a market's gaining 8% a week, listen, this is a terminal part of the move. Markets don't do that every day. So that's whenever a market goes straight up, whether it's silver or kumquats, it means that the end of the move is coming. So that shouldn't have been any terrible surprise. On the silver, as I said, we're going to get a chance to buy. We got close to it today. The low was just a little bit above 32. Somewhere around 30, we're probably, or 29, we're probably going to get a chance to buy. And then with gold, if not 1445 or 1450, then 1380. Those are both possibilities.
Uh-huh.
It's less likely that gold will hit its 200-day moving average, but it's certainly possible. So this is not the end of the world. This is just a correction in a bull market.
And well, it's very interesting. If you look at what we said in the year-end wrap-up,
yes,
we said, you know, that silver would correct during the, you know, probably. You thought it would come later. You were closer than I was. I thought it would start earlier. And, you know, but we said it would correct in the, you know, coming into the summer. And then we expected more, higher highs at the end of the year. So I don't think anything's changed. The only thing I will say from my point of view is it ran up more than I expected to do before the correction.
Oh, way more than I expected, which also just points out, you know, number one, you and I can be wrong, too. And number two, we've moved into a second stage rise, and it's much more powerful than what you expect. And goodness gracious, if it acts like this in the green tree, what's it going to do in the dry? What's it going to do when it gets to the third stage of the rise and goes straight up for a long period of time? There's just no telling.
Now, a lot of folks have swapped out of silver and into gold during this period.
Mm-hmm.
So when do we swap from gold back into silver?
Well, I haven't made my mind up on that yet. I have no question that the ratio will at least rise back up to, say, 47 or so, 46, 47.
Uh-huh.
But I think there's a very good opportunity, very good chance that we'll see 58.
That high?
Well, that's the halfway point of the 84.3 down to 32 move.
Right.
And, you know, it's certainly a possibility. 50 is a possibility, right around 50. So I'm not ready to say yet where that is, but frankly, right now, I'd rather be in gold than silver anyway.
Right.
So
right.
I'm not. You know,
well, except I like to have a core holding of silver, particularly physical,
yes,
that I don't trade out of, because let's face it, there are times when silver has a liquidity that gold doesn't have, you know, in the small amounts. And so I would never want to give up that core position.
Right. But what I'm thinking about chiefly is 2008, when the ratio turned around and gold performed, even though they both went down, gold performed much better than silver. And that was in the face of a once-in-200-year financial panic. That's the reason. So,
right.
There, you know, when there's that much weakness in the financial system, I'd rather be in gold. But you're right about holding a core position in silver.
Right. Well, that's why Fukushima, as soon as Fukushima happened, I said, out of silver into gold.
Right.
Here we come. Yeah.
Right.
Well, there's some other factors, too. What's going on in the background is a very interesting game on the dollar. And you may not have heard me last week. I talked a lot about what I call a covert QE3, which I believe is going on.
Yeah.
But we, you know, the dollar's getting a bounce, but I suspect that behind the scenes, just to I covered this last week, but when a national emergency is declared in a situation like occurred with the tornadoes,
uh-huh.
It gives the federal government wide latitude to access tons of funds, particularly in the mortgage funds.
Yes.
So I used to have a deputy who would say FHA is where mortgages go to die. You get a national emergency, and it's the perfect time for all the banks and the Federal Reserve to just push mortgages back into FHA.
Well, you know, another thing is that the rise in the dollar is just as much a collapse in the euro as it is a rise in the dollar.
Right.
That is, the whole Greek problem has reemerged. Greece is bankrupt, but the euro, the European community and the European Central Bank can't let them go bankrupt without hurting a lot of German and French banks. And, of course, nothing in this world today is done that will ever hurt the banks. So clearly that's put a huge amount of pressure on the euro, downward pressure on the euro, and the euro cracked against the dollar. Well, the euro is, I can't remember, 55-65% of the dollar index. So that explains a lot of it. But there's an alternation, too, and it's just about time for the dollar to have a little rally.
Right. Right. I've been surprised, though, this week that, there's a lot more support for gold and silver than certainly we would have seen last year, the year before. You just get a feeling of it, Franklin, that it's a much broader base market.
Oh, goodness, today. The market opened up today with silver. Gold had gone as low as 1478, and silver, as I said, 3232, and they just steadily kept coming back all day long. It was a very strong day, and you wouldn't have seen that a year or 2 years ago. There clearly gold has a lot of friends under $1,500. Silver has a lot of friends.
It does.
$5. Well, they do.
Yeah. No. It does. It really does. And it was hard for me today not to buy. Because
yes.
I kept reaching to start to buy, and then I said, no, I got to talk to Franklin first. I want to see if he agrees.
I wouldn't be against buying here because I frankly don't know where the market will go, and you're, goodness gracious, way, long ways off from the top. You've certainly fulfilled, a third correction. Maybe we'll go farther, but it's possible you could have seen the low already in silver.
Yeah, no, I'm inclined to start at 32 and not everything, but a little bit.
Right.
So, I'm inclined to start here. And the only thing that's stopping, or the big thing that's stopping me, is I know, summer is coming. And, I think, how can this possibly be the low if summer's coming? That's the one thing nagging at me. Okay, top 10 dates. We have an updated transcript with all the dates so far that Franklin and I have covered. And tonight we're going to talk, Franklin, about the 1967-68 repudiation of the silver certificates.
Right. Well, what this really, U.S. government monetary policy with silver, beginning with Roosevelt, had set the stage for this gigantic silver bull market that began about 1960. The first leg of that market peaked in 1968, and it also probably motivated the Hunt brothers' later silver purchases, and it certainly set the stage for the gigantic bull market of the 1970s. So here's how that started. Roosevelt had been trying to manipulate the silver price upward. And by the 1950s, most of this had been accumulated under him, but the stockpile had reached 3.1 billion ounces of silver.
Wow.
So in the early 50s, the Treasury became the largest supplier of silver to industry. They were selling silver at 90.5 cents an ounce, which is 38%, nearly 39 cents, below the statutory silver price, which is $1.929 an ounce.
Where did they hold, Franklin, where did they hold the silver?
Goodness gracious, I don't know. I can't answer that question. Where would you put 3.1 billion ounces? They've got a big closet in D.C. somewhere. I don't know. But they had the 3.1 billion ounces. And the problem was that in 1959, the market price of silver rose above 90.5 cents. And to make matters worse, vending machines had arrived. And there was a huge new demand for silver coins. So in the face of all this was going on in the face of flat mining output. And the more silver that the Treasury sold, the more the price rose. And it was obvious that some kind of collision was coming. In 1934, under the Silver Purchase Act of 1934, Roosevelt had shut down silver trading in August, silver futures trading. Well, in June of 1963, it cranked up again. And by September of 1963, the price of silver was above the $1.29 statutory level. At that point, it became profitable for people with silver certificates to take them to the Treasury, swap them for silver, and then sell that silver coin on the open market, because they could get more for it as bullion than it had value as legal tender. And the problem for the Treasury was, not only were they suffering a drain of silver from other directions, but they also were required by law to maintain a certain silver reserve against all those silver certificates. So they could envision a time where they would have to buy silver on the market at a price higher than $1.29 an ounce just to maintain their silver reserve. And, you know, the same thing had happened back in 1853, almost 100 years before this, where the world market price of silver threatened to go higher than the statutory price. But at that time, Congress still had a little integrity left. So what they did was they took the dimes, quarters, and halves, which until that time had been a half, a quarter, or a tenth of the silver in a dollar, and they reduced that subsidiary coin by 6.5%, the content by 6.5%. So in 1964, Congress is facing a similar problem, but with considerably less integrity. They voted to remove silver from the coinage altogether at the end of 1964. That's when you began to see these cupro-nickel sandwich coins. Now, they did leave a 40% silver dollar, but that was just a lame shell of its former glory. What happened in 1964 and 5 was, when the realizers saw that the U.S. government was removing silver from the coinage, they immediately began to hoard silver coin. And that only made sense because the record of history plainly showed that whenever a nation removes the silver from their coinage, you're getting ready for a huge hyperinflation. Well, right. the silver kept disappearing and threatened to deplete the silver certificate reserve, and so finally Congress had to act. So they did the exact same thing that they've always done since 1861 when they get into a monetary tight spot. That is, they reneged on their promise. In this case, it was the promise to redeem the silver certificates for actual physical silver. So on the 24th of June of 1967, Congress passed a law that gave the public warning that they had 1 year to redeem the silver certificates. After that year, the U.S. government would no longer redeem them. Well, what that did was it set off a rush to buy silver certificates, because the silver certificates were basically a way you could buy silver at below market prices. And the Treasury did not really show a good grace about the whole thing, because they had stopped paying out silver dollars in 1964 for the silver certificates. When the silver rush began in 1967, they paid in the trashiest forms they could pay in. They literally paid people in silver shot. They paid them in these grease bars, which weighed roughly 100 ounces. It'd be an odd weight. And it wouldn't have any stamp or anything on it. It just had the number of ounces marked in magic marker. So this went on until June of 1968. Well, when it started on the 1st of June of 67, silver was selling for about $1.32 an ounce, which is only about 2% over the statutory value. A little less than a year later, on the 20th of May of 68, silver had reached $2.65.5, which is more than double the price of 11 months before, and twice the statutory value. In that same period of time, the gold-silver ratio had dropped to 13.5, which was about half of where it had been a year earlier. So that was the first blow-off episode of the 1960 to 1980 silver bull market. The thing that you don't want to miss here is that this was the last link, this was the breaking of the last link with real money for the domestic U.S. population. In 1933, when the U.S. government had reneged on gold convertibility, American citizens domestically were still able to use and get silver, silver coin, silver dollars, and silver certificates. But after the silver certificates were repudiated, there was no place that American citizens could get gold or silver money anymore. And so what that meant was, from 68 forward, the U.S. domestic monetary system consisted only of fiat money, and most of that was the private banknotes of the Federal Reserve. So private money had been substituted for all forms of public gold and silver money.
Right.
And then the aftermath of that was that there were significant profits from that silver certificate rush, and that was enough to attract other investors and to set off the next round in the silver bull market. In the late 1960s, there was a fellow named Jerome Smith, and he wrote a book called Silver Profits in the 70s. Good book, good forecast. What that did was that sparked interest in a lot of other people like Harry Brown and a whole crowd of newsletter writers, and it bloomed into this enormous publishing and investment industry promoting hard money investments. So along comes Bunker Hunt. Now, you have to remember that he had become wealthy on his own. It's certain his father had made a huge fortune, but he had parlayed that family wealth into a fortune all his own. And he started buying silver in 1972 or 73. He later said he couldn't remember when he started buying it. But contrary to government propaganda, Bunker Hunt and his brother Herbert never set out to corner the silver market. They bought a lot of silver, and they had a lot of rich friends. And they told all their rich friends, some of whom just happened to be Saudi oil sheiks, to buy silver, that it was going up. And what happened was, when silver went crazy in 1980, the government and the head of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, scapegoated the Hunts. They blamed everything on the Hunts. And to keep Wall Street from crashing in March of 1980 after the peak in the market, Paul Volcker had to arrange a bailout for the Hunts, and he did that not because he liked the Hunts, but because all of Wall Street was threatened with collapse if he didn't do it. So all through the rest of the 1980s, the government, especially through the IRS, sought vengeance against the Hunts. And in fact, Bunker took bankruptcy in 1988. So the lesson is that Wall Street does not like to be beaten, especially by a Texan.
Well, the Texas got them back in the 80s with Iran-Contra. Because when you looked at all the mortgage fraud, Texas got most of the money. we have a couple quick questions from subscribers before we go to Let's Go to the Movies. One of them I just wanted to address. The question is, do you think J.P. Morgan Chase still has a huge naked short position? This is something Franklin and I have covered before. I don't think that J.P. Morgan Chase has a short position in silver. I think J.P. Morgan Chase is agent for the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a treasury fund, is managing the U.S. government's position, and they probably have freedom to use what they do with SLV to help them do that. But if you go to my blog and do a search for Catherine and Silver, about last week I put up a radio show I did in January about why I thought the idea of buying silver to crash J.P. Morgan would not work, because you're basically trying to crash the U.S. government, and it's a whole different kettle of fish to crash somebody who's got a nuclear arsenal than J.P. Morgan Chase. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Franklin.
No, that's exactly the way I look at it. I mean, I don't doubt that there's been a huge silver manipulation. I believe they had to manipulate the silver because they were, Larry Summers and Rubin were trying to raise, to lower interest rates, and they had to manipulate, they had to suppress the gold price to do that, and in order to suppress gold, they had to suppress silver. But J.P. Morgan Chase would never have undertaken to operate as their agent if they had not had full coverage.
Right, and I do want to say, because I think Goldman was a very important part of that operation, is my guess, because Blankfein came out of the precious metals area and ran fixed income, which was both mortgages and precious metals. And I cover all of that. I've got an article called Goldman Whack-A-Mole where I cover that in a series on Goldman Sachs. But I think the, you know, and that's one of the reasons you explain how a commodities trader got to be chairman of Goldman Sachs, because I think they were a very important part of that operation. Another quick question, how aggressively do you think they will reduce margins to keep the metals down? Seems to me that the next new highs on metals is something the Fed is going to fear and an ominous sign for the currency. I don't necessarily agree, and we've been covering this a lot, but I think what the Fed wants and the central banks want is a managed fall of the dollar and a managed rise of commodities. And every time you run a situation where the commodities get too speculative or throw a managed situation into political stability, they try and cool it down. So they're part of managing this shift from paper to real things. And you know, in many respects, I think the syndicates behind them are taking enormous advantage of it, because they've been swinging us back and forth between paper and real things for centuries. But I think they want to manage process and they just cool it down whenever it gets too out of hand one way or the other. So Franklin, anything you want to add?
Well, I think you're accurate about that if you look at the timing of the central bank's moves. But more than that, it's been my expectation all along that at some point during the course of this bull market, the benchmark price would no longer be the futures market price, the paper price, I call it. Rather, it would become the physical market price. And we saw that decoupling in the fall of 2008 when the ratio, the physical ratio never went higher than 70, but the paper ratio went to 84.3. So I think you'll see that again. And the margin requirements clearly affect a huge number of people in a huge segment of the market. But I think eventually it will no longer be the futures price will become a joke, so to speak. And I know that's hard to imagine now that that would happen, but they're doing it to themselves. They're making
I think that's absolutely, given what we saw in the last 4 weeks, I think that's absolutely, I think you're right. That's absolutely possible. Well, it's very appropriate that we should now turn, and I hope you'll join me, Franklin, to The Truman Show, and let's go to the movie. Because The Truman Show was sort of the fictional harbinger of reality shows. For those of you who haven't seen it, The Truman Show, came out in 1998. It's a comedy with Jim Carrey, who plays a character named Truman Burbank, who was the first human to ever be owned by a corporation. He was legally adopted by a corporation at birth. And the film chronicles his life as a man who is unaware that he's living in a constructed reality TV show and is being broadcast 24 hours a day to millions of people. And he has a job in an insurance business and a wife and, finally realizes something's quite not right and ultimately realizes he's on a movie set and decides to leave it. Now, why did I want you to watch The Truman Show? We've done over the last 6 to 8 months a series of different Salieri reports on what I call invasive technology, technology that really fundamentally changes how privacy works and whether or not it can work. Part of Clifford Carnicom and Dr. Scott on chemtrails and the impact of chemtrails talked about the extent to which the nanoparticles in chemtrails were really creating something that a network could operate on. I had you watch a very creative, and if you go back into the archives, you can find it, version of the Stravinsky's opera, The Nightingale, and in it you have a little barcode that's flying around and putting a barcode on every item in the entire universe, and it's kind of a artistic rendition of the dynamic I'm talking about. We did spy chips with Catherine Albrecht about literally putting digital chips in all of your possessions, and literally so you could be tracked, and all your possessions could be tracked. We talked with Blake Levitt about electromagnetic radiation in fields, including cell towers, smart grids, and literally building this kind of network into your home where utilities can turn your appliances on and off. We watched recently, last month, The Listening, which is a movie that talks about how the NSA can, an echelon, can literally listen and watch you in your home through your cell phone. We see this week the announcement that the government reserves the right to be able to text you on your cell phone whenever they want. We haven't done security cameras and systems, but we should. All of these different sort of invasive technologies are part of a building block of something that's going to come together and integrate and literally turn all of our homes into the equivalent of the Truman Show. And that's why I think the Truman Show is very prophetic, and I want you to look at it with a new eye after listening to our descriptions of these different technologies. And one of the dynamics I want to really underscore when we talk about this is that part of the reason that technology can be so invasive is because we do have competition between different groups. So we have, as John Rappaport would love to say, we have the medical cartel, we have the energy cartel. So we have phone companies, we have utility companies, we have government intelligence agencies and their contractors, and all of their are competing to get the most data on you, and to, you know, if they can get more data on you, then so if the phone companies can get more data than the utility companies, that gives them more power. It gives them more power to raise their prices, et cetera. So you have all these guys at the lower level competing to invade your privacy more than the other guys so they don't get outfaxed by the other cartel. And that's part of what's making this so invasive, because there's enormous redundancy when you start looking at all the data that's being collected. But it's important for you to understand it, because the risks involved have very significant legal and financial implications. As I talked about with Blake Levitt, it's in the transcript, which is up at your cart. We put this quote up at the blog when I pointed out, well, if a utility company can do something that dramatically raises your prices and destroys your health without you being able to stop them, then basically they have given a private corporation the ability to reduce the value of your home to zero. And Blake agreed with me. She said, that's right, and that quote is up on the blog. So one thing to understand, the way a lot of the professionals can front-run the markets and retail investors is because they can have access to this kind of data and aggregate it. So I hope if you like watching movies, you'll watch Truman Show, but you'll watch it with a mind's eye to sort of integrating all the different pieces of invasive technology that we've been talking about. Now, I take it, Franklin, from visiting your farm, that they're probably, you're the last person they're going to try and put a smart grid on.
You better believe that. There wouldn't be much to see anyway. You know what? I'm sitting here thinking as you're talking that the worst part of this, and it came out in the Truman movie, is the dehumanization that it implies. Not just implies, but realizes. You know, in 1984, Orwell dealt with the tyranny of a state that watched its people all the time, and in a different way than Truman was watched. But it is the same kind of manipulation. It's the same kind of dehumanizing tyranny. And in a certain sense, the Truman type, or the type that we're subject to, is even worse than the other type. Because in 1984, at least, all the surveillance is unpleasant. In this case, you don't have the unpleasantness to make it obvious what's going on. But the end result is the same, that everyone is dehumanized.
Right. It's funny because I think at some level people know it. This is a funny thing for me to contemplate because, you know, I lived through 24-hour surveillance for a long time during the litigation many years ago. And it was funny because I'll never forget it was – I can't tell you how shocking it was. I had somebody contact me and say, you know, there's this kind of technology where they can literally sort of videotape you inside your house, and they said they're using that on you. And it was a very reliable source, and I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, I had to contemplate the fact that that was possible. And it just, frankly, I can't tell you, it was so shocking to me. And, you know, to live in a world where, you know, you have to assume in the worst case there's absolutely zero privacy, everything you do. So I went to church that Sunday, and the pastor, he was very angry. You know, he really had worked up out of steam. And he said, you know, you're worried about what other people think about you, but he said, you better start worrying about what you and God think of you, and that's all you really have to worry about. And I said, you know, I that makes sense. I'm just going to worry about that. I'm not going to worry about everybody else, because that's really a higher standard.
Yeah.
And what was funny is, as soon as that happened, it all just became funny. Do you know what I mean? And I stopped worrying about it. I just stopped worrying about it. And I'll never forget one time my attorney and I were on the phone, and we were talking about getting a manicure because she's a woman. And I finally said, you know, I feel so sorry for those guys in the FBI. They worked hard. They went to law school. You know, they wanted to do something important, like put away big mobsters. And instead, they got to sit here and listen to us talk about manicures. I feel terrible for them. And the phone went click, click. And I said, oh, my God, Carolyn, did you hear that? And she said, no. I said, guys, she didn't hear it. Could you do it again? They said, click, click. Anyway, so, you know, there's a way to deal with it. But I do think it pays to, and this is why when people say, you know, they're going to break the law, I say, no, I don't think that's a good idea. So watch The Truman Show, and you'll have a better understanding on why Franklin and I say, please never, ever, ever break the law. Okay, well, Franklin, I'm homesick, but this has been deeply satisfying, at least to talk with you. And we'll be back next month. There's going to be, I don't know, I think precious metals is going to be an intense topic for quite a while here, because I agree with you. This is a long-term bull market, and life's getting very interesting.
Absolutely.
Anything else you want to say in closing?
Well, I could tell you about how much you're missing because all the rambling roses and the honeysuckle is in bloom.
And there are tons of bumblebees around you.
Ah, you better believe it.
Yeah. Okay, that's it for this week. Next week, Jim Norman, Oil Card Geopolitics. I'm so glad we're having Jim back because, as you can tell, the oil card is hot and heavy. We got some good oil card questions, which I'm going to put to Jim next week. And then first week in June, we have I'm just very delighted, coming into us from Munich, the Bertram Verhaag. He's the director of Scientists Under Attack, the new documentary on genetically modified food. It has wide application beyond genetically modified food because it shows you what can be done to experts who try and bring out the truth. This time it's GMOs, but it really gets to the heart of answering your question that I get sometimes, why is nobody doing anything? Because they're under attack. Again, transcripts up on your control panel of Break Leavitt, and transcripts for the top 10 dates through last month. By next month, we'll have up the one, including the one that Franklin did tonight. Lots of good stuff. Please share those transcripts with family and friends and other people that you want to draw into your conspiracy. And please remember, until we talk again, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.